The views and opinions expressed by A Little Bit Culty are those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the podcast. Any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business, individual, anyone, or anything. Hey, everybody. I'm Sarah Edmondson.
And I'm Anthony Ames, a.k.a. Nippy.
And we just want to welcome you to season three of A Little Bit Culty. Once upon a time, we were in a cult called Nexium.
We didn't know it was a cult when we joined, because as a wise man once said, nobody joins a cult. They join a good thing.
For a minute, it was a good thing. That's where we met, fell in love, got married, started a family.
The stuff of storybooks.
Even the part where we woke up, escaped, became whistleblowers, and helped bring it all down? You call that shit show a storybook?
Seeing the mastermind of Nexium get sentenced to 120 years in prison? That's a storybook ending, if you ask me.
The whole thing was captured on HBO's hit docuseries, The Vow.
A new season is coming out any moment, if it isn't out already by the time you hear this.
And I published a memoir called Scarred, which is available anywhere books are sold.
And now we have a podcast.
Every week on A Little Bit Culty, we call on experts, advocates, fellow survivors, and whistleblowers to help us unpack what's going on in the cultiverse.
And now we're turning our story into wisdom for other people.
Like, I wish I'd known that calling yourself Vanguard was a bit of a red flag.
Yeah, big red flag. We've got a lot to cover. So let's get this show rolling, shall we?
Welcome to A Little Bit Culty, an Acast podcast about the fads, beliefs, and trends that blur the line between devotion and destruction. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And to learn more, visit us on Instagram or alittlebitculty.com. Hey, everybody.
Does that mean me or our audience?
Well, hi to you and everybody audience. Nippy and I are in the same apartment, but we record from different rooms. So,
and I can look down behind me, and every time I do, Sarah gives me the middle finger.
It's just my way of saying hello from the other room.
Well, yeah, you stole that from Top Gun.
Did I?
Yeah.
I don't even remember Top Gun, so I don't think I could have stolen it. But it must have informed my psyche in some way, like so many things did in the 80s. Anyway, by the time this drops, this will be our episode dropping March 21st, and we will have come back from South by Southwest. Real time, we are going to South by Southwest.
World War III might be underway.
Yeah, this is a crazy time to be alive. More on that later. But today, we have an incredible guest. But before we get into that, did you have anything you want to say about the cultiverse? Anthony?
It's still thriving, unfortunately.
Yeah. We got a bunch of people reaching out to us about the Melanie Wilkings story. Have you followed that at all?
I have not. Have you?
Well, just because people sent us her Instagram, where it's her and her family talking about how her and her sister were like TikTok dance stars. And apparently her sister got caught up in something that her family is saying is a cult run by, it's called 7M Films, which is an offshoot of a Pentecostal sect that believes in something called the Seven Mountain Mandate and is holding Miranda hostage. But Miranda and her husband are saying they're not being held hostage. They're there willingly, and they don't want to speak to their family because their family says that they're in a cult. So it's sort of catch-22, but it reminds me, Nippy, about how, you know, when we were in Nexium, the fact that certain people weren't supportive of us, like, you know, my family was very supportive, but like I had friends and extended family that was always very judgmental and not supportive. And that lack of support fortified me going deeper into the cult. So like in the moments of, you know, making a decision of like, are you going to attend so-and-so's birthday? And me being conflicted about that, they would say, well, what's more important to you? Why would you want to spend time with your family if they don't support you? If they're not in line with your values and they're judging you and they're stopping you from, you know, reaching your potential, why would you put any effort into that family? You know what I mean?
I do remember that. That didn't work on me.
No, it didn't work on you, but it worked on me.
I mean, I understood it.
And I think we should do another episode, and we will, about how to deal with family members who are caught up in this stuff. And maybe we'll send it to Melanie and her family if that is indeed what's going on. It's hard to tell right now.
That's a good idea.
People need to know.
It's a process, right?
People. Yeah.
You know, there's going to be what people are going to say when you confront them and how to address
that. Yeah, because if you say to people who are in a cult, you're in a cult.
Nope.
It just makes the people go, you know, you don't understand what I'm in. So you can't do it like that. episode to come on how to deal with your family. This episode is something that we've been trying to do for a while and to address the concept of the cult of one.
I just took the post-it off my board that had been up there for a year. Sarma in the books. Sarma.
So if the producers of Tiger King decide to make their next Netflix true crime docuseries about your life, you've got quite the story. And that is our next guest today, Sarma Mingales.
In the early 2000s, Sarma seemed to be living a charmed life of glamorous celebrity chef and foodie media darling. Her fancy pants, raw food restaurant, Pure Food and Wine was much buzzed about, as Sarah and I can attest. And her camera-ready image as the queen of veganism really seemed poised to take her global.
Fun fact, Pure Food and Wine is reportedly where Alec Baldwin met his future wife, Hilaria, for the first time, and where Tom and Giselle like to do the occasional date nights once upon a time. I dragged Nippy to this restaurant so many times, it was my favorite restaurant in Manhattan. More to come on that in the actual interview.
Then, circa 2015, Sarma vanished. Literally, she disappeared, leaving a whole crowd of angry employees, landlords, and investors in the dust, claiming they'd been stiffed.
Under investigation for a heaping bowl of fraud accusations, labor law violations, and a hefty tab of unpaid wages, and with $2 million drained from her restaurant accounts, Sarma the celebrity chef becomes Sarma the runaway fugitive overnight.
That's got to be quite the whiplash. One minute you're living the glam Manhattan high life, the next you're in the shadows of Appalachia, and according to the tabloids, living on Chipotle bowls and Domino's deliveries in your Dollywood hotel. Hollywood to Dollywood.
How does someone go from being a foodie it girl to, as one media outlet reported, and I hate this, the vegan Bernie Madoff? That's awful. How does a graduate from Wharton Business School actually do the thing that's so hard to do, which is make it as a New York restaurateur, wind up at Rikers?
We don't want to spoil anything, but there's a culty-sounding player involved in Sarma's fall from grace. It seems that she fell under the sway of a gambler with a criminal past who slid into her Twitter DMs with shady moves straight out of Keith Raniere's playbook. And she married him. Cue the alleged gaslighting, alleged sleep deprivation, and alleged sexual humiliation. Pro tip, if you come to believe that your pit bull is on the cusp of being made immortal, you've been mindfucked.
This is the story that the highly anticipated Netflix series, Bad Vegan, Fame, Fraud, Fugitives, will explore. We're already planning for binge watching. Maybe a watch party with Chipotle's? No. Sarma, I'll be drinking my green juice in her honor.
Wherever you land on Sarma's spectrum, whether you think she's the ultimate con woman or the victim of mastermind, you have to admit, she's got guts. She joined us so we could ask her the burning questions about what landed her on the next Tiger King and how the con worked.
Here's our chat with Bad Vegan's Sarma Mingales. And when your personal trauma becomes clickbait, how do you come back from that? But behind the clickbait headlines, there's always more to the story. And in this case, that story is a little bit culty. And guess what? Sarma is only speaking to us. This is an exclusive on A Little Bit Culty. Sarma, I'm not even going to say your last name. I'm just going to call you. I think from now on, you are like Oprah and you're just Sarma. I'm going to anoint you.
It would make my life easier.
Sarma, this is like probably the most long-awaited interview that we've had. I mean, we've only been going for a year, as you know, but we've been talking about having you as a guest since we started.
Monday mornings, I'm brushing my teeth and listening to your podcast, and it's been like a big part of my therapy.
I'm so happy to hear that.
I feel kind of afraid of doing interviews, and I don't feel ready hardly at all. And listening to her podcast has been incredibly therapeutic. It's rare that I don't stop and rewind and stop and rewind and write something down and have a bunch of insight and have a good cry. And there's just been a lot that has been helpful. So that's why I feel really happy to be here.
How are you doing right now? How are you feeling? You're not home. You've got some green juice from the road. What's happening?
I am. I'm a little cagey about my whereabouts in general and where I live for a variety of reasons.
We went through that.
Exactly. Yeah. Because the guy is still out and about.
Wait, he's not in jail?
He was out before I went in. He was released from jail before
I
went
part.
In. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
He was released before I even went in to do my time. That was a little challenging.
Just to let people know where we're at in the timeline, we're recording before the Netflix series Bad Vegan drops. We wanted to connect with you before it comes out and see how you are and to get your story in your words, long form, because we don't know how it's going to be edited, right? Mm-hmm. And then maybe we can connect after it's out and ask the questions that come up when we watch it, right?
Yeah, because I haven't seen it at this point either. So it's definitely a really nerve-wracking time. I haven't seen it either. So I gave interviews. I don't know how it's going to be presented, but my goal with it was, as long as it was done honestly and in a way that was useful, that's my goal with it.
And how did you feel just watching the trailer?
I think immediately I've sort of developed the skill of going numb very quickly to things. But it was a bit jarring. I kind of feel like I was expecting it to be. So that's, you know, It is what it is. They put a lot of the sort of more salacious bits in it.
It's almost like they have to,
yeah,
to get listeners. So, I mean, to your point, my expectations of storytelling right now, just through what we've been through, are It's going to be that way. My character is probably going to take a hit just in the trailer. Do you know what I mean? And I think savvy audiences know that. You know, and if they don't, give them time. Do you know what I mean?
It's like that with tabloids. It's like, you know, savvy audiences usually know that majority of that is spin or not correct or whatnot. But then a lot of people kind of take it at face value and take it for what it is. And then that's just the way it goes.
And the people that know and love you are somewhat undeterred by that, I find.
Yeah, usually, hopefully. Going through something like this, one of the things that happens is, even though my situation was a one-on-one situation, there's sort of this automatic closeness that I feel to you guys. Or I think you mentioned you might interview Hoyt Richards, like, amazing guy. I've chatted with him, and it was sort of like you have this immediate connection as if you went through something together, even though you went through separate things, but they were the same sort of thing that most other people don't understand. So you sort of have this immediate kind of bond. That's been really comforting.
I would call it a wisdom.
Yeah.
It's a wisdom if you transcend the abuse, you understand what happened, and you turn your experience into wisdom, and then you can articulate it for other people, which is why podcasts, in my opinion, have become so valuable for situations like this, because even your story on Netflix, it's being curated and filtered through someone else who has an impression of you.
Yeah.
Good and bad. Like, I kind of feel like, you know, we got positive monikers that felt fraudulent to me. In as much as we got some character assassinations that were disproportionate. Long form interviews to me allow the audience to go, how authentic is this person? How are they when they're asked a hard question? As long as the platform is used like that, I think, you know, people can make, I think, more informed decisions and take the wisdom from your story.
Yeah. Another thing about my particular story is that it's just incredibly confusing. It's just a confusing story. And then I had my large gaps in memory, and then I had bits and pieces that I've pulled together. And I was really, really lucky to be able to find as much correspondence and material that I was able to find. And going through that, I was able to sort of jog my memory about things that happened. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people ask questions, well, why did you do this? Or why didn't you do that? Or what happened here? I'll find myself thinking, oh, I don't remember. I just hope that the documentary is done in a way that's useful and helpful for people. In all likelihood, maybe some things will be missed or kind of not quite correct, but not necessarily their fault at all. It's just, I even am confused in trying to articulate my story in kind of the very long form of writing it. The thing about my experience too, is I feel like I'm always going to have unanswered questions.
Mm-hmm. That's inevitable.
Yeah. There's sort of a tendency to want to know, why did he do this? What was he thinking? What was his goal? And I realized pretty quickly, that's just sort of a wasteful exercise because A, I'm never really going to know. And B, it doesn't really matter. One thing I know is that I know he doesn't give a shit. and I just know that his psychology is so wildly different from the one that we share and that most of us share, that trying to kind of put, you can't put yourself in their shoes and try to understand what they were thinking or how could he have done this to me? It's sort of a wasted exercise.
Well, one of the things our audience has been asking for, and we've been trying to find the right story for it, and we'll probably do more, but really it's the story of the cult of one person being you know, manipulated, gaslit, abused. One of the things that was just so bizarre and full circle for us, as you know, when we first connected, did somebody connect us or did you? I can't remember how we connected.
Steve Hassan, I think, sent us Steve Hassan. Did an email intro. Yeah.
That's who it was. Oh, bless you in a not religious, culty way, Stephen Hassan.
Yes.
For connecting us. And he's done some wonderful connections for us.
Yeah, he's great.
We're very, very grateful for. But I will say, again, to you, and this is why it was so heartbreaking to read the rough draft of your book, which is fantastic, and you need to get that made, and we'll talk about that later, that you ran and you owned, you created this masterpiece of a restaurant called Pure Food and Wine. And for our listeners, if they don't know, it was just this magical, sexy, raw, vegan oasis in New York that it's just so full circle for us, because I would be going to New York to be going to Albany to take trainings, and I'd always stop through Manhattan specifically so I could go to your restaurant.
But also, Sarah, you forget one detail. Our center was 3 blocks from her.
It was?
That's right.
Yes. The ESP, the Nexium Center, from 2008 to 2011 was on 13th and Broadway. I'd go over to One Lucky Duck, grab some cashews. I'd go over there once a week, maybe.
Wow.
You know, maybe a little bit more, maybe a little less. And then every time Sarah came to town, we'd go in there and eat.
I have to tell you two more things real quick about that.
Yeah.
I had to drag Nippy there at first because he wanted some meat.
That always happens. That always happens.
It's true. It's true. I know. I read that part where you like people.
Yeah, no, that happens a lot. People come in reluctantly, and then they're like, "Oh,
I'd always complain, but there's nothing like this."
I was slapping food
out.
No,
he'd be like, "This lasagna is mine. Stay off my raw lasagna." And the drinks and the
desserts were.
When you describe the restaurant in your book, all these memories came back because it was sort of fuzzy. It's been a long time since I've been there, and when you describe the wood and the napkins. And the organic wine list and the sake cocktails. And I get excited just thinking about this restaurant. And it was not even mine. So
yeah, I mean, it really was. It was an incredibly special place full of really, really special people, you know, some of whom are in the documentary. It was a family there. We had a family and it was a really, really special place. You know, I was so committed to it, almost like it was my child that I would defend and protect at all costs. And so this strange nightmare happening where it ends up being destroyed and then appears to be having been destroyed by my own hand is sort of like the most backwards, twisted, like absolute horrific, nightmarish scenario, because all I ever wanted to do was to protect that place so that it would last, you know, forever, or, you know, especially the brand. It was one of the, I wanted it to outlast me. I wanted it to be a thing that would go on and go out in the world. And there were two parts to it. There's the restaurant, Pure Food and Wine, which was, as you know, that was sort of like the fine dining experience. And then there's the One Lucky brand, had a much farther reach because people could order the products online and the juice bar, and you could put maybe more juice bars out and about. We had a couple of locations. That was the more expandable part of the business. The One Lucky brand meant so much to me. So I kind of wanted it to be a brand that took healthy, you know, in this case, plant-based eating and sort of made it more mainstream in a not sort of crunchy, granola, fringy way, kind of made it fun and sort of cool. And
you did.
And accessible.
You totally
so,
did.
Yeah. So for that to be crushed and gone is like my worst nightmare. And then layer on top of that I'm somehow blamed for it all. You know, how would I have wanted that to happen? You know, I was in a position where I pled guilty to things. And I'll just say that, you know, it happens all the time that people plead guilty to things in order to just have it be done and over with, as opposed to, you know, enduring some months or years long trial and costing $1 billion that isn't available. It's been a interesting experience having that be part of the story too, that kind of not only did all this stuff happen, but then it appears that I somehow meant for it to happen or did these things and therefore it happened. And yeah, I'm hoping that the documentary conveys things at least relatively accurately. And then I hope that when I'm able to get my story out in long form, that it'll help make it even more clear what really happened. Mm-hmm. And I hope that it'll help other people see that this can happen.
Well, I think the book, from what we've read so far, certainly will fill in many gaps. And one of the things that really stood out for me, again, having been a fan of your restaurants and your brand and everything, is just how committed and how much of it was clearly your life. And I wanted to show you this. This is my keychain.
Oh.
Can you see it?
It's very cute.
It's a silver duck. And for those who don't know, Sarma has a duck tattooed, the logo for her brand tattooed on her arm. And I feel like that means something that people need to know. Like, I believe you in that. Like, obviously you did not want this to happen to your baby.
I had the logo tattooed on my arm very early because I did, you know, I branded myself with the brand. Mm-hmm. And I know, I feel like I just said a triggering term. Sorry.
It's okay. No, it's
you.
Okay.
In a different way, because I was so committed to it, I don't know if this comes out anywhere else, but that year after I disappeared, he tried to convince me to kind of get another tattoo to cover it up or somehow get it removed. And I was like, no. I mean, I thank God I didn't somehow let him convince me to do that, because that would have just been miserable.
You did wear a Band-Aid over it while you were with him, right?
After we disappeared. Yeah, because he didn't want me to be recognized. And in my whatever strange state that I was in, I sort of had an awareness. I didn't use my real name. I didn't tell people who I was. So it was just kind of easier to keep it covered, because part of what my tattoo did in regular pre-Mr. Fox life was I'd be out and about and people would ask me about it all the time, which was kind of a marketing thing, especially if mm-hmm. I was carrying a One Lucky Duck tote bag on my shoulder at the same time. Mm-hmm. People would notice that the tattoo matched my tote bag, and then they would ask me about it, and then I'd get to explain my brand, and then, you know, they'd go look it up, and it was marketing. So, of course, when the shit hit the fan, I didn't want to get asked about it.
Yeah.
What would I say? How would I explain it? Right. I didn't want to get asked about it.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
And I know we're jumping in mm-hmm. the timeline, so let's just mm-hmm. circle back to, we call it the good years in the heyday of Pure Food and Wine and One Lucky Duck around the corner and Sarah Nippier coming in to do NXIVM ESP recruitment parties. And I have such a vivid memory of being there. I don't remember who it was, but it was some high profile yoga teacher. And we were having like a 10-person dinner with some like other raw foodies and some friends of mine who now live in Sedona. And like, I'm almost positive you were there. Like, I really feel like we met at least once. Like the owner's here.
Oh, I remember.
Yeah. Do you remember that party? And we were like, I think we were trying to recruit them into NXIVM, and they were probably trying to recruit us into their yoga, whatever they were doing. Either way, it didn't.
Battle of the cults.
Battle of the cults. But either way, it was
in your restaurant.
Yeah. You know, nice. Like it was the, you know, celebrity spotting, beautiful restaurant. Anyway, so cut to, you know, years later when I come back and it's not there and I found out it's closed, and all I know is tax evasion. That's the only thing that I hear about you. And I didn't even find out the full story. We're still finding out the full story. So let's just, if you can, and whatever you want to share, I know a lot of it's going to be in Netflix, but mm-hmm. we would really, like, the purpose of our podcast is to give people, you know, the red flags so that they can see them and avoid them in their lives and also heal if they've gone through something similar. So as best as you can, because I know it's how many years from start to finish, like 6 years? 7 years from when he came into your life to when he left?
It was like the very end of 2010, beginning of 2011, when he came into my life. And then there was this period of time where I kind of pushed him out a bunch of times. And I thought, like, all right, well, this is weird. And I don't want to see him again. And then he would find his way back in. That sort of took a while. And then it really sort of ramped up in 2012. You know, the story of how it started, you know, there's so many parallels to how people get pulled into cults, because I had gone through what I describe as my first time being heartbroken, because I had broken up with a boyfriend who was a really, really, really good guy. It was a relationship that I knew wasn't going to last forever because he was 13 years younger than me, but it was an amazing, drama-free, just pure, lovely relationship. When that did end, I was super heartbroken, was having a hard time getting over that, and was also overwhelmed with the business. And rewinding a little bit further, there's sort of a whole other story of, you know, the origins of the business. I originally had a partner. We opened it together. There was some drama there. I ended up in a situation where I was carrying a lot of debt. So already I'm kind of in a compromised, vulnerable position on various fronts. Carrying debts and running this business on my own, which was doing really well. And there was the downturn in 2008 where so many restaurants in the city closed, and we weathered that and got through it. And it was a lot of work with the restaurant. And I sort of, most of the time, aside from all of the amazing people that worked there, I felt very alone running it on my own. And I always longed for the perfect ideal partner and felt like a lot of the wrong people were coming at me. And that just made things more stressful. And so layer onto that being heartbroken. And there were just a lot of things going on at the same time that made me particularly weak in the face of somebody knowing what they're doing and coming at me in a manipulative way and saying exactly what I want to hear and directly and indirectly saying, implying, making me believe that they can deliver me this or they can bring me relief. From all the stories I've heard and things that I've read with people when they get pulled into cults, sometimes their weaknesses are being preyed on. And I don't mean weaknesses. I just mean that if you're going through a hard time, vulnerabilities is what I mean.
Yeah.
And combined with people who have a tendency to be idealistic and want to do good things.
Yeah.
So I had kind of all of those things going on at the same time. So here's somebody coming to me and over time sort of making me think that one way or another via him, you know, I'd be sort of liberated from these things that were holding me back and that I would be able to grow the business the way that I want to. And I'd be able to do the things that I want to and not be alone with it. And so, yeah, he was preying on kind of both idealism and vulnerability at the same time.
100%.
And it starts like, you know, with cults as well. I think everybody says this. He didn't come at me and with these crazy stories and say, I can make your dog live forever and blah, 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 blah.
Right.
That's a part of the story that the press likes to glom onto is about my dog. But it's not like he came at me with all of these crazy promises and stories from the start.
No.
As people have described, it sort of ramps up slowly and slowly and slowly. And then you're kind of, by the time you realize things are a bit wonky, you're in too deep.
It's indoctrination in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And that first encounter with him, it also started because you noticed that he was exchanging with Alec Baldwin on Twitter. So there's this, you know, he's already elevated to a position of trustworthy from whatever that means that he's pals with Alec, right?
Yeah, there's like a Wall Street term for that where investors will fraudulently kind of give themselves validity by associating themselves with somebody who has validity. He did that. And it's certainly a red flag, or at least something to be very, 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 very careful with, is meeting anybody in any kind of an online context where you're not, I mean, you're vulnerable meeting somebody face to face on another level. But what he did really well is started with these exchanges on Twitter where I had been friends with Alec and Alec was sort of new to Twitter. And I noticed he was sort of bantering back and forth with this guy on Twitter. And I sort of somehow in my brain just thought that like they were actually friends, or again, it just gave him some sort of validity as. And so he and I started chatting back and forth, and then it just sort of developed from there. So, I mean, I think people are used to nowadays, you kind of meet somebody online and you chat and you become friends, but obviously it can go horrifically awry and it can also be dangerous. And then another thing that people should be careful with is, you know, for better or worse, I've always been very open. So I had on my website, I had all these blog posts that were very personal. In interviews, I was very open and personal. Even right now, I'm being open and personal, but hopefully I know now not to let somebody use that against me. But I have a tendency to be too open and to say too much. And so here's this guy and he's sort of ramping up being interested in me and asking me what's going on and probably also having read my whatever was I had written publicly or things I'd said in interviews. So he already had an understanding of my weaknesses and vulnerabilities. And then I would also just easily be too open with people about things. And so that process begins where he starts collecting almost, you know, useful data for him to then later weaponize. And I think that, you know, like that process where you're asked or forced to give up collateral, he did the same sort of a thing, just a little bit more indirectly and slowly and over time.
And gaslighting you, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He collected dirt on you in a covert way versus, you know, give me a naked photo. He had your vulnerable, emotional, metaphorical photos.
Yes. I later found out, I wasn't surprised, but he did take a bunch of videos of me when I wasn't aware. I think some of them ended up in the documentary, but I have a few of them. And what's interesting is if you said to me, oh yeah, he recorded videos of you, of course you'd be horrified thinking, good Lord, what did he record? But he recorded me as if he was trying to gather evidence that I was insane or emotionally unstable, because all the recordings are of me crying sometimes on the floor. I can't even say words. And he's recording me as if he was gathering evidence of my being unstable and cuckoo. But I look at it and it's like, well, okay, clearly I wasn't. This is evidence that flies in the face of the narrative that he and I are running off gambling and buying Rolexes and having a grand old time.
Well, it's evidence of his cruelty as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And what's really kind of grotesque is his voice in those audio clips. He's holding the phone so you can hear his voice talking to me as if I'm a child. And he's like, come on, you know, he's like trying to calm me down. And
he's very patronizing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They're kind of grotesque. But it's just interesting that he took all those videos. And in the end, they work in my favor because, yeah, they show kind of how fucked up it was.
Yeah, when you're around somebody like that and you're getting gaslit, you're going to, if you express yourself and you're caught in that trap, you're going to look crazy. You're going to look emotionally unstable. That's the thing.
Well, that's what they do.
I've been in that situation before where somebody's provoking you, and then you snap and you get angry, and then they're like, aha, you're crazy. It wasn't even that, which that's a thing that happens all the time. That's like a tactic of people like this where they'll provoke you to explode and get angry, and then they point to that as evidence that you're the crazy one. I look like I'm on drugs. I can't speak. I'm crying, and he's talking to me like a child and kind of being like, you know, get up, get dressed, and I sort of look like I'm barely functional.
We tell our stories. We change the world. A Little Bit Culty is proud to support the hashtag I Got Out project, which empowers survivors of cultic abuse to share their stories online as a catalyst for education, prevention, and healing. Learn more about the hashtag I Got Out movement and find resources at igotout.org.
Well, the distinction I'm hearing is like if someone's just trying to get your goat and make you crazy, it's less sociopathic, narcissistic behavior as opposed to I'm going to create a series of steps strategically with the end game of you agreeing to my assessment of your craziness and me confusing your world. And you actually describe it pretty well in a paragraph in what I've read so far about how you would leave a situation with your brain a little bit scrambled and stuff like that. You're describing, and I don't know if you've done any reading of like Dan Shaw or Yanya Lalich,
yes,
that, but the 16 traits of a narcissistic sociopath.
Yes.
I mean, those should be taught in schools.
I agree 100%. And I feel like one of the things I would like to come out of talking about this is that there should be a wider conversation and a wider understanding of sociopathic behavior and what to look for.
Absolutely.
Because it's so dangerous and scary.
Well, I'll tell you what'll happen. A lot of CEOs of companies would get outed and a lot of people in positions of power would get outed pretty quickly if people are armed with the knowledge of what these things look like.
Yeah. And I'm sure you guys see it all over the place too. It's like sometimes there's people out in, I mean, there's one very obvious example in the United States where we look at it and go, you know, you hear pundits kind of analyzing the situation and you go, well, okay, but none of this stuff is surprising when you look at it in the context of there being a sociopath.
Sure.
It's all expected.
The pundits don't know what they're looking at.
Right.
It's emotional for them, and they can't clinically evaluate behaviors objectively so as to inform people because they have their own reactions to it. And that's what allows the narcissist to win.
Here's another scary thing is that I had read at least 3 books about sociopathy before I ever met Mr. Fox. I was relatively educated on sociopathy before that. There is something about, I don't know, maybe this is a whole different conversation, but being aware of it is sort of step one. I mean, he mm-hmm. also knew that I was aware of it. So somehow he worked around it.
He moved very slowly. The thing that really struck me from your book is that you very clearly laid out, like you said, your emotional state, your breakup, the financial strain, and then just that void, that like loneliness that I think is very normal. And if anyone thinks that they're like never going to feel that, then they're never going to love. So, you know, good luck to you. But there's this void that I really felt so clearly in your book that, you know, you fill with food and you fill with like social media and trying to get the likes. And then here comes this guy who you're talking with online. You have an elevated view of him, thanks to Alec. And you, not that we're blaming him, is just how it happened,
right?
Just to be clear. And then he's giving you the things that are like, obviously so directly the opposite of this guy that you were in love with. And I totally get that. I think a lot of women have had that experience where like you get out of a relationship and, you know, the guy only eats Caesar salad. And
a lot of men,
and
too.
And men, too. Yeah, any relationship. Sorry, so, any relationship. Yeah. Any relationship where all of a sudden you're like, you're with the opposite. Yeah. And you're like, oh, she eats bocconcini and doesn't like Caesar. Like, she's the one. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't make, it's just like the opposite. You want the opposite and you want to be kind of like, fuck you to the other person. And this person fills the void and it feels great. And not only that, he was offering you things. And this is where I go back. Sorry, back to the, like, I don't know what it's like to be a man. So I'm just talking about for me as a woman in this case, like he's protective and he's promising you like the comfort and like to, you know, take the wheel for a minute, you know, and you haven't had anyone take the wheel. And I totally got that.
He's predatorial with his promises.
Yes. But what, yes. But what I'm saying is I understood the hook.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And the thing about people who are smart sociopaths is because of the way that they're wired, it's like they're very easily able to look at other people and read them and immediately yes. see what are this person's insecurities? What buttons can I push? And that's why they're so good at manipulation, because they very, very, very quickly can read people, a situation, and know how to manipulate it in their favor.
Well, you nailed it. I mean, what I've noticed, and I would say that the behaviors that we're talking about, the predatorial behaviors, do mostly come from men. You rarely hear about predatorial women.
Yeah, they exist. I mean, there are a few examples out there, but it is much more common in men.
Yeah. And I think from what I've seen is, well, Sarma, you're going off in your life trying to build something and do something. That's the world you're studying in. You know, Sarah and I, we want to build something. We want to build something of value, like you said earlier, something that lasts after you're gone. Mm-hmm. What I see consistently with these types of people is they study how to manipulate people.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, it starts early. The one you just listened to, this kid was going from ages 11 to 17.
Oh, bento
to
take box? Trainings.
Bento box.
Yeah.
Yeah, the bento box. And so you have to understand by the time you...
Oh, box and the fox.
I wait.
I have to
like have fun with these things because it is dark stuff, but... You have to understand these guys, by the time you meet them, they're 15, 20 years in and studying people's manipulations yep. and understanding it. And you're not. And you can't assume, like, for you to project that that's what they're up to means that you do it. And you just don't. It's hard for you to understand. And, you know, we had a great meeting a few months ago with a producer who produced a great film. And she was talking about her story. And it was clear that she had something similar because you can tell. There was no judgment. There was empathy. And she mm-hmm. described really, really well to us. It's like, well, it's like any con. People don't understand that they were conned until after the con is up. You don't know or assume to do that. I mean, it can be a card game that you walk into.
Yeah.
And then you go, oh my God, this guy was cheating. Or like, well, you don't cheat. So why would you assume people are cheating?
If you have a trusting nature and you're generally a good person, we're not trained to walk around assuming the worst of everybody and being skeptical and running everything through the filter of maybe this person's a sociopath. We're mm-hmm. not running that through our filter. And the other thing that happens is there's the element of like these lies are so crazy and fucked up that it's almost easier to believe that they're true than that somebody's so bizarrely crazy that they would tell them. You know, because you
the bigger the lie, the easier it is to
exactly
digest.
And it's so hard to fathom. When it got further into it and, you know, and he started taking, you know, getting money from me and it just got more and more painful and horrible, it didn't make sense to me that somebody could possibly be that diabolically cruel. And it's even not like so much a rational intelligence thing. It's just like on an emotional human gut instinct level, you think, well, nobody could possibly be that horrifically cruel. So that must totally not be what's it. Happening. It must be what they're actually telling me, which is some cuckoo bullshit story. But it gets
right.
Psychologically, you get in a position where more and more you so desperately want to believe the cuckoo story because that's the only way out.
Mm-hmm.
What happened was when he started getting money from me and then I started to get more and more compromised, then to say to myself, wait a minute, you know, he must be full of shit. I would have had to acknowledge that I'd already made a colossal mistake. And now
mm-hmm.
when I was already feeling really down, I've just royally fucked myself because now I'm in a couple hundred grand of debt. You want to believe what they're saying. You want to go with it. And then, of course, what happens is, you know, multiply that couple hundred grand by 10.
Well, and here's my take on that, too, is they know that that reconciliation is hard. And mm-hmm. I think they doubled down then.
Yes,
of course. They, force they know exactly what they're doing.
They sense your dichotomy and they go, in order for this person to make an about face and pivot, they got to do something really, really hard. It's such a mind fuck because they understand that you're going to go have to eat some humble pie and crow to your friends, to your constituents that you've been probably doubling down on his character mm-hmm. and defending for a while. And so you have to be wrong. Really, they reconcile that it's hard for people to be wrong and make that pivot.
Yeah.
In this time, did anyone warn you or mm-hmm. did anyone try to be like, who's this guy? Or was it all happy roses and unicorns?
It was not happy roses, unicorns. One of the things that made me a good target for this is that I tend to be on the introverted side. I tend to kind of keep to myself. I didn't tell anybody about him for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so he definitely capitalized on that. You know, that worked in his favor. I didn't have like this very, I mean, I was very overworked and I had a lot of people around me, but not in a very, very, I didn't have like that lifelong best friend who I spoke to every day, who knew everything that was going on in my life, who would have stepped in and gone, wait a minute, who is this guy? What mm-hmm. the fuck? And what they do very well is when people did get suspicious of him, they find a way to put up barriers between you and that person or try to get that person out of your life.
That was my question. Did he direct you to be secretive about him? Did he strategically slander other people that you were close to? Was he that involved?
I think in probably a lot of subtle and not so subtle ways, he developed that dynamic, which again is very common when in the whole cult thing, which is that us versus them. So
right.
this is something that developed over time, but more and more he sort of developed himself into this figure of authority that knows things that most other people don't know. And
mm-hmm.
people out there are sheep and I chose you because you're smart and you can change the world and you're meant to do all these powerful things and everybody else, they're all sheep. And so, again, it's not like one conversation.
By the way, I wanted to tell you, I wanted to rewatch the trailer before getting on with you. And I just happened to scroll through the comments. They're very supportive. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've looked, but almost everybody has been like, I've been there. She's a good person. Clearly she was fucked with.
Yeah, I didn't look at any of the YouTube comments, but a couple of people told me that and that felt really, really nice. And then also, I think there was one comment where somebody said, meat suit is my new stripper name.
Obviously, that's a thing in the trailer. Meat suit? Oh, no. I need a minute. So they should watch the documentary.
Yes.
And then they'll find out what the meat suit is.
They'll find out. Yeah.
I'll say this, Sarman. I told Sarah, I think, multiple times when we were being interviewed, the way to make your story wisdom and content is to tell everything as vulnerable as you can, as honest as you can, even if it incriminates you. And yeah. from what I've seen so far, if you're lying, you're saying a lot of damning things about yourself and things that are very personal to the point where, why would you do that? In terms of long form interviews, podcasts, and where they have their value, it's, you know, how do people handle tough questions and how vulnerable are they? And I think that's where the power of your story comes from. And I think you've done that as far as I can tell, unless you're pulling one over on all, right. which I don't think you are.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, kudos to you for that. And I think, you know, you're going to experience a lot of goodwill if you haven't already, because you've demonstrated that so far.
I mean, it's a really hard thing to talk about. Again, that's why I feel so comfortable here with you guys. Whereas, you know, say I did an interview with, I don't know, some random anonymous, like, kind of entertainment oriented thing where they could easily splice things in a way.
I fucking hated those.
Oh, I'm sure.
With Sarah did not do them. They're your meat and your clickbait.
Speaking of meat,
exactly.
There's a couple. I just was wanting to pull Sarah out of the room when we were doing some book tour stuff. I was like, they don't give a shit.
Yeah. It's a really difficult thing to talk about and navigate where I'm in this weird kind of stew of like, yes, I take responsibility. Things were my fault. I did things, but I didn't do them with the intention that people think that I did.
Right.
And, you know, I was being influenced by somebody else, but I don't want to like, you know, sit there and play. I don't want to be all victim-y about it.
Right.
So
right.
You walk this very delicate line. It's very easy if you're kind of talking too quickly or something's taken out of context for people to spin something or present something in a way where it looks like, you know, it could look like I'm not taking responsibility, or it could look like, well, she's not sorry, or it could look like I'm making myself to look like the victim too much or not enough.
It's very complicated. And trust me,
it's very messy.
No matter what, there's going to be people who don't like how you do it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm preparing myself.
Prepare yourself for that. Yeah. Prepare yourself for people, shitting on your character and making assessments and judgments. And you have to just stay, you know, strong in that truth for yourself about who you are.
And support too.
Yeah. And get that support. Listen, before we get into that, I need to circle back. Like we said earlier, we're not taking our audience through your whole journey. You just can't. That's what the, you know, Netflix and your book will be for.
We would be here. Like,
you'd be here for hours.
10 hours.
But the main nuggets I wanted to just share with people is what those red flags look like. And you mentioned the thing about just because you meet somebody online doesn't mean that's who they are. And there are a couple of red flags that stood out to me in your book. Is there anything else that you want to share? Like for example, the thing that you said about the first time you ever saw his eyes in a photo, or was it in person and you got spooked?
At first it was in a photo and I got spooked because his eyes in the photo even were really intense to the point where it was scary. And again, this is something to be careful of, is what happens in the face of red flags is you rationalize them away, not really knowingly. You just sort of, you rationalize them away somehow or another. And then one of the things that a lot of these people do in person, there is a characteristic of the sociopath too, is that stare, the intense non-blinking stare, which probably, and somebody like Steve Hossen would be better equipped to talk about this in detail, but probably has strange hypnotic effects. Because one of the things that happened is I've recovered a lot of our correspondence, and going through all of it, I was always struck by how much I was pushing back on him, pushing back, pushing back, pushing back. But then I remember, because he'd be trying to get me to send him more money, right? And I'd be pushing back on him and fuck off, fuck you, and in our correspondence. And then like the correspondence would stop because, you know, he came over, I was with him in person for a while. And then you look at the records and it's like, oh, then I sent him a wire for $50,000. Then I sent him a wire for $10,000. Then I sent him a wire for $15,000. And I'm thinking, okay, I was pushing back on him. But then when I was with him in person, whatever he said got me to do what he wanted him to do. But I don't really remember all those conversations. I don't remember all that in-person interaction.
But do you think he was hypnotizing you? What do you think he was doing?
I don't know. I just know that his power was incredibly strong in person. And it clearly had to have been a weaker connection and power when we were apart. And so that's probably why so much of my sort of chat conversations with him that I have documented, I'm pushing back on him so much of the time.
Just out of curiosity, what was he saying he was using the money for? What was the vision that you thought you were embarking on with him?
So you guys will understand this, because when you ask that question and I answer it and say, I don't really know, I didn't really understand, because he obviously did the opposite of articulating anything clearly. So he would say these weird things like the money was being shelved. Well, what does that mean? Are you taking it actually in bundles of cash and putting it on a shelf? Like, what do you mean the money is being shelved? He would say things to me. And then he sort of created this story, narrative situation where it's as if the money didn't matter and he was putting me through these tests. All along, it was like just about to be over. So it was like, well, just do it, like just this one more time. Well, you have to just do this one more hard thing and it's all going to be over. And so he would get me to, you know, he would get my brain to rationalize like, okay, well, if I just do this, then it's all over. And then I get everything back, then it will all be okay. He'd always say to me that not only would it all be okay, but like, say, I mean, the really gross painful part of the story is that he got me to borrow money from people. So what makes this situation painful beyond my own personal pain is that other people were harmed via me. And so I have to kind of carry the guilt and the shame of that. But he would always say, you know, like, oh, all these people are going to be taken care of. So, you know, if I borrowed money from somebody, it was as if they'd get it back tenfold if they wanted. It didn't matter. Nothing mattered because, you know, it would all be undone, or they'd get it back, or they'd all be money whipped, is what he'd say. And again, I'm not articulating any of this very clearly because it wasn't very clear.
Mm-hmm. We understand that. And again, like, we're going to refer people to the series and the book when it comes out and fill in those gaps. And hopefully this episode will be another layer of understanding and education specifically around this concept of the cult of one, that people can get conned, you know?
Yeah. And I think what's so important for people is to be as kind of awake as possible in your life and relationships and involving new people in your life. But what's so scary is that first hook, the first time he got me to give him money, and I don't even remember the exact amount. Was it 12,000? Was it 10,000? Was it 6,000? But they find some way to sort of trick you into like, oh my God, this is an emergency. I just need this right now. And it's like, oh my God, you need me to help you? What? Okay, well, I can help you. I'll do that. So whatever that is, that initial hook that they get in. And then of course, you know, he never paid me back. Maybe he paid me back 10%, mm-hmm. and then with the promise that the rest was coming, and then it just snowballed from there into this massive boulder of debt.
Yeah.
You know what he did with any of the money?
Well, now I assume he gambled it all away. I'm pretty sure he just gambled it all away. Oh, yeah. I think he just took it, went to the casino, and that's why periodically he would come back with some money to validate that, like, none of it matters. Here's a bunch of money. But then he wouldn't give it to me. You know, he wouldn't pay me back. He'd maybe here and there, he would pay me back a little bit.
He had a track record, correct? He was arrested a few times, like 50 times, was it? Did I read that?
I think he has a significant arrest record. I don't know the exact number, but he was arrested for all kinds of things in the past, I believe. Allegedly. Mm-hmm. I don't, throwing out all those qualms.
Allegedly. Yeah. Before we get to finding out more about him. So you have these red, and again, we're skipping big chunks in the story.
Yeah.
And you didn't wake up from this in the way a lot of other people wake up from cults or abusive relationships, because he took you off the grid for about a year. Is that right? Before you were found?
Almost. I think it was about 9 months. Yeah. He, yes. I mean, the sort of tabloid narrative was that we were fugitives on the lam, whereas he basically just took me away, actually screaming, because I do remember screaming in the car, like screaming and crying in the car. I was hardly on the run. But yes, he took me away, and it was about 9 months. And I didn't have the wake up that most people do. It was more like I was forced awake by getting arrested, which it's a very strange situation to feel like this affection and gratitude to the detective and officers who arrested me, because they pulled me out of a bad situation, even mm-hmm. though I was getting, you know, and it wasn't so much in that moment, even though I was appreciative that in the moment they were very kind to me because I had Leon with me. And so I was freaking out that Leon was going to go to a pound, and I was really worried about Leon, and they were very kind in that, in the situation in the moment. But you know, that's what pulled me out of it. And when I think about what if that hadn't happened, what if they hadn't gotten to me, how long would this have dragged on? Like, what would have happened otherwise? I don't know. What people ask me that a lot. Like, well, what was his plan? What were you guys doing in Tennessee, which is where we were arrested? I don't know. I have no idea what we were doing there. I have no idea what the plan was. I have no idea. You know, well, did he have money? I have no idea. I think at that point he had run out of money, and I was tapped dry in terms of what he could get out of me. Yeah, getting arrested is what yanked me out of it. And I know that sometimes, you know, I think in other people's cases, I think even Steve Pawson in his book writes about having gotten into a horrible car accident.
Yes.
You know, that was the thing to kind of get him temporarily out, and then he got fully out. So sometimes it is like
it's an extreme,
a horrible accident, or getting arrested and physically being yanked away from him.
It's something extreme. And everything you describe for people that hated us for what we did mm-hmm. have subsequently been like, hey, you freed us.
Right.
Hey, culty listeners, lovers of cult busting content, ALBCers, culty kids, We've gotten a lot of requests to put up a link where people can throw some funds up behind the podcast and help support what Little Bit Culty is doing. And you know what? That's a great idea. Thank you for that. And as we've gotten to know other podcasters and learn more about this whole podcast thing, we've been learning that it takes a whole lot of different resources and different sources of revenue and listener support to keep it rolling. Sponsorships and ads and the occasional appeal to amazeballs listeners like you. That's why we added a way for anyone who wants to support the show to do exactly that. You can go to littlebitculty.com/support or the link in our Instagram bio, or smash that link in our show notes to make a one-time contribution or a recurring one. We will pay your support forward with a galactic level of love and light and healing resources, of course. Again, it's littlebitculty.com/support or check out the link in our Instagram bios. Next up, we really got to figure out what to call you, our listenership. ALBC Nation? Flying Monkeys? We're going to have to workshop that. Thanks, guys. I just wanted to comment on your description of being arrested and being in jail, and was heartbreaking. And also, you're very funny. I want you to know, like, your book has some funny moments. And I, of course, like, not as hardcore with my diet as you are, but I was also imagining I could not eat any of that. Like, when you're like, I just need to be hydrated with my lemon water. I'm like, I'd be the same way. I'm like, do you have a banana? You know, and having real food, like, you know, you have a very particular lifestyle. And then I just felt like so awful that we didn't name Nippy for Mr. Fox, Mr. Fuck Nugget Fox, whatever you want to call him, like how he used your credit card to order Domino's and then you get the rap. Why are you getting shit for ordering Domino's and breaking your vegan diet?
I didn't order it. I didn't know about it. So the way that I found out about the pizza, I didn't even know there was a pizza. I didn't know a pizza had been ordered. I'm in the jail, the holding cell in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, and it's a couple days into it, I think, and, you know, the way I'm like, you know how holding cells are. People are coming in and out. So this woman comes in and somehow she looks at me and she's like, hey, you're that lady from New York. And I'm like, oh, hello. Like, how did she know that? And she's like, I saw you on, and she's of course saying this with a thick Tennessee accent. She's like, I saw you on TV. You're that lady that got arrested because of the pizza. And I'm like, what? The pizza? That's how I found out there was a pizza. And then subsequently when the detective, I was in this holding cell for a very long time, days, many days. And they told me that they were getting calls from press outlets. And there was this kind of big to-do about the pizza. And I was like,
oh my God.
They said, you know, in the grand scheme of things, of course, it's like, who cares about the pizza? But it was, you know, they were like, well, we told them you weren't eating the pizza. You weren't in the same room as the pizza. And I'm like, huh? Okay, what? And what's interesting, and just kind of grotesque, is the extent to which even after there were a couple of interviews where those same, you know, officers, detectives are quoted saying she unequivocally had nothing to do with the pizza. It's kind of out there. I didn't know about the pizza. It, like, the tabloids don't care. They'll continue running the headline saying that, like, you know, vegan restaurateur is arrested, busted with a cheesy pizza. Like, it's too good of a story for them to let go of the pizza.
It's really like, Nibby and I were just talking about how the love-hate relationship we have with the media in general, but, like, you know, how the salaciousness of the headlines, your story and our story, like, you know, on one hand, we're happy he's being exposed. You know, on the other hand, when your personal trauma becomes clickbait for, you know, for them to make money, it's like, fuck you. At least hold, and it's awful.
And it's even like, if it's clickbait, yet it's somehow worthy. Like, if it was clickbait that was leading to education. And I said this in the process of the documentary, like, if there's something that embarrasses me, but it's embarrassing in a way that that's useful for other people, that's okay. I can handle that. I've been humiliated. There it's embarrassing.
Go. Yeah.
If it, like, I don't care about being embarrassed if it's useful to the story, if it's going to help people, if it's going to lead to greater understanding. But if it's just this kind of grotesque pile on of, like, the, you know, people are just giddy over, you know, what they perceived as somebody putting themselves forward to being a vegan, which I didn't even necessarily do. And I wasn't even, didn't have anything to do with the pizza. And I'm such a food snob that I'm like, really? Domino's?
Yeah.
Really?
I wouldn't eat Domino's.
If I was
going to
eat pizza, I would, you know. So it's like, yeah, it's clickbaity in this kind of grotesque way that serves no purpose. And that's what's really gross.
Well, and it's unfortunate that there's an appetite for it.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah, no pun intended.
Well, all of that completely chaps my ass, specifically regarding the media and what they did. But is there anything in particular that you want to share that no one else knows that chaps your ass and regarding Mr. Fuck Nugget?
Yeah, Fuck Nugget.
I'm going to work on that
okay,
one,
yeah, Fuck Nugget. It's not that original. I don't know. I just, yeah, Fuck Nuggety, yeah. Foxy, Fuck Face. Sorry.
Yeah. But yeah. I mean, it's funny because there are so many things that chap my ass. And when you said that, I was thinking that like, you know how foxes are cute? Mm-hmm. There's sometimes foxes on pillows. And like, I can't, anything with foxes, I'm like, get it away from me.
Of
I don't want to see it. Yeah, foxes are ruined for me. But there are so many kind of smaller things that chap my ass. And I feel like that's the whole chap my ass thing. It is usually like the sort of smaller irritating things. But I think the biggest thing that kind of genuinely chaps my ass is that everything that happened and everything that he did and he got and everything that's been destroyed, at the end of it, he walks away clean slate. And yet I'm left with an enormous pile of debt that, if I think about it for too long, is crushing. And so it's not like, oh, my life was destroyed. Everything I cared about was ruined and other people were hurt too. But at least I'm starting fresh and I can start. It's like, no, I'm not starting fresh. There's this enormously messy, you know, piles of various varieties of debts and things that not only do I have to deal with one way or the other, but like feel the shame over it. And even if rationally I know, like, well, I didn't intend for any of this to happen in a million years, it doesn't matter. I still feel the shame of it. I still have to carry that. And he doesn't. And he kind of walks away like, okay, he can, you know, clean slate. He can go off and start screwing with other people and getting on with whatever he's doing. I don't even want to imagine. I'm sure it's already underway. And that chaps my ass, I got to say.
It does for me too. But listen, Sarma, just a thought, like as a friend, is it possible for you to, like moving forward, clean up the mess, which I understand you need to do for yourself, but like without the shame and the weight, like, you know what I mean? Like, is it possible just to fix without beating yourself up?
I try. All of it is so, so messy. You guys know this too. This is another hairy subject I have to deal with, is there's this perception that, oh, you're in a documentary and it's on Netflix, therefore you must be, you know, rolling in money because of it. And you guys know, like, you know what I mean? Like, do you get paid for doing The Vow? It's a documentary.
Nope.
Exactly. Exactly.
What are the subjects?
Exactly. And so in my case, and this is something I have to articulate in a more formal way, but a couple of years ago, in the beginning of all of this, this conversation of the debt, the part that really upset me and really weighed on me the most was the, by far the smallest amount that I owed, but what was owed to my employees. It was after I disappeared. You know, the restaurant was chugging along for a while and I'm gone and nobody knows where I am. And so there's all these paychecks in the end that never got paid. So they didn't get paid. And then that turned into this judgment. And that amount of money, that's what weighed on me the most, because these are, you know, people who were whatever, line cooks, dishwashers, servers. That was paid as a result of my agreeing to do this. But again, I have to kind of articulate that more clearly. But yes, the point is I did not get paid and
yes.
I'm not rolling in it as a result of this, which is a perception. I'm sure you guys got that too.
Oh yeah. No, people thought because that we were in a series that we made lots of money and, you know.
We got out right before things hit the fan and we knew everything the whole time.
Yeah, yeah. Or that we like had a plea deal. But like, let me summarize. You earned some money through doing Netflix that you used to pay your employees. That was part of the deal.
Well,
yeah?
Employees were paid. I was bypassed.
Oh, I see. Part of agreeing to do the documentary before it even got to Netflix was that the people you owed money to were going to get paid.
Yes. So my former employees, that entire amount was paid. And I think sort of it finally went through from attorney to attorney bypassing me 2 years ago. And it just like coincidentally went through on the day of New York restaurants being shut down because of the pandemic.
Oh, wow.
So I thought like, oh, hopefully in this moment where people are suddenly losing their jobs and nobody knows what's going to happen, at least some, you know, they're going to get word like, oh, by the way, that money that's owed, that's coming through, or that came through.
How did that feel?
So, I mean, it was a relief no matter what, but just the way that it was timed felt like more of a relief.
Have you had any closure with any of those people personally? Like, have you been able to talk to any of you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, even before that, a lot of the people that worked there reached out and extremely supportive because, you know, I feel like what they went through is probably like watching mom hook up with this horrific, evil stepfather and not understanding how that happened and feeling betrayed. right? And so mm-hmm. they probably felt betrayed that here I was, you know, this dude that I allowed this dude in, and then everything got destroyed. And so it was kind of my fault. But they all knew. I mean, see,
they know
they,
you.
They knew, right. They know yeah. me. They knew how much I cared about that restaurant, and it was my entire life. So they knew that, like, they knew something was very wrong.
Right.
Because they knew I wouldn't mm-hmm. have done that.
No, so, you were the mama bear. You're the mama bear of the whole thing. Like, you were, I saw that in your book and everything. I get it.
Yeah. And I mean, the other really, really, really heartwarming thing is that so many people who, you know, were just customers or had people that, you know, read my cookbooks and my blog posts and somehow interacted with me, even all so many of those people out there intuitively knew immediately that something went very wrong. Like, they may have been like, I have no idea what happened, but, you know, oh my God, I'm so sorry for you, because obviously you didn't want to torch your own restaurant and, you know, what your whole life was devoted to. So that's been really heartwarming.
That's encouraging.
I bet you you'll get receive even more of that support once the docuseries comes out.
Hopefully all that's captured.
I hope so.
Yeah. I mean, I know it's been pretty gut-wrenching to not know, to not be able to see it yet.
I have another piece of unsolicited advice as your new friend is do as much writing as you can right now about what's happening right now and what it's like when it collects. See if you can pull yourself out. So the regret that I have is when The Vow came out, I didn't write. And I, since your book isn't out yet, you could have a chapter on this part, you know, and the healing and the restorative justice that you're a part of, and, like, you know, what you're doing to fix things is a big part of the story. I just like, that's not part of mine. And I wish that it had been, I wish I'd recorded it. I was in the, like, the clusterfuck of the aftermath of The Vow, and I wish I documented it.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think one of the most important things is that ability, which is something that you really have to practice, and which I've practiced and started to feel like I'm getting better at, which is being able to kind of step back. A lot of chaotic things might be going on, but, like, being able to just step back quietly and go, okay, like, take a deep breath. What's going on here? Mm-hmm. Like, get some perspective. Am I okay with this? How do I feel about this? Let me think about this for a minute. Let me wrap my brain around this. And being able to step back and have that quiet time, I think that it's kind of like, you know, if you're in a situation and maybe, you know, maybe you're at a party or in a situation or something, and somebody, like, says something really kind of gross or something, and you kind of go, huh? And then, like, an hour later when you're home brushing your teeth, you're like, oh my God, what an asshole. Like when you've been able to step back and get perspective on something, you go, oh, wait, that's not right. Or this isn't how I want things to be. Or I feel like I'm having to do that all the time now, and just stepping back, and instead of just kind of getting overwhelmed and, like, taken for this really bumpy ride. And I think that that's part of what can happen to get oneself into the situation in the first place, is that the more chaos there is, the more confusion there is, the harder it is to step back and see what's really happening. So I'm feeling like what would have served me back then is something I'm trying to be aware of right now, in knowing that things are probably going to get a little more chaotic for me. And I want to kind of keep being able to, like, run and hide for a minute and take a few deep breaths and think about it.
Yes. You don't have to answer. You said, I'm going to think about that. I'll circle back. Add it to a to-do list. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
As I tell Sarah, she calls social media social meads. Social meads isn't the real world.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
It's about 5%. It's about 5%. Yeah. And normally it's
a very loud 5%. It's like a screaming 5%.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a little brat demanding your attention.
People are going to listen to this. Yeah, we're going to suggest they watch the series first, but if they don't and they're hearing this for the first time, or to anybody, I guess, what do you want to tell people that you really, like, what's your main nugget of wisdom that you wish to impart?
Oh, good question. I think it just somehow has to come around to avoiding stepping into something like this. Mm-hmm. And part of the way to do that is to, as much as possible, cultivate self-awareness and thoughtfulness about who you're getting involved with, who you're letting into your life, and stepping back and evaluating it and thinking it through. And I know from experience that you might think that you know. Again, you know, I had read books about sociopaths. I've been in terrible situations before with bad people, so you'd think I'd know better. Then it happens again. Then it happens again. And it happens again. And I feel like I've been slapped around enough to go, okay, I finally get it now. You know, like whatever, universe, like I get it now. I'm done with the lessons. The best defense is just continuous knowledge and understanding and self-awareness and stepping back and being very cautious about who you let into your life and who you trust. You don't want it to be this thing where, oh, don't trust anybody. It shouldn't be a negative thing, but just to cultivate enough self-awareness to be very, very cautious, in particular when you're somehow down, like if you've suffered a defeat or you're going through a breakup or having an awareness of potentially being in a vulnerable situation and being extra cautious. I know that's not a very like soundbitey nugget of advice, but
you know, it is.
It certainly is. And I would agree with that. But there's a caveat I like to add to that, because there's a lot of people who go, oh, well, that's not me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right there.
Oh, yeah.
And I would say this, were I one of those people, a narcissistic sociopath, and someone demonstrated to me that they think they're not susceptible to that kind of stuff, I would target you.
Yes, I know. Well, that
because that works in my favor.
Exactly. I mean, that comes up a lot because people sometimes have this perception that like, well, I must have some character flaw, defect, or I'm just kind of stupid in some way or whatever it is. I mean, that moment in The Vow where I think they were in a coffee shop, somehow they're talking about it with these people in a coffee shop and somebody in there says like, oh yeah, well, that would never happen to me. Like the classic line. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, well, that would never happen to me. And it's just, I felt that like gut punch of what that, because I know what that feels like to hear that.
Normally someone who says that has probably had that done to them and doesn't even know it.
Exactly.
In some shape or form.
Exactly. And then there were so many valuable things that I learned while, you know, listening to your podcast every Monday morning as soon as they dropped. One of the interviews you did with Mark Vicente when he talked about how people look at somebody like Keith Raniere and his ridiculous knee pads and the volleyball and his goofy ways and they think, wait a minute, how could people have followed that guy? And I get that as well, right? People are like, what? What was she doing with that guy? How did that happen? And then they think like, well, maybe it was some sort of crazy, like I was just in love with him. And it's like, they don't really get it. And then I also didn't quite get it. It's like, there was something missing where I was like, yeah, what the fuck happened? And there's the part when your interview with Mark Vicente, where he says that what they're able to do is they find a way to present to you like an idealized version of yourself, who you kind of really want to be. And then they sort of create this dynamic where it's as if they're going to bring you there. They're going to deliver it. Mm-hmm. And like, that's what you get attached to.
Yes.
That's what you're attached to.
Yeah.
And when he said that, I was like, oh, that makes so much sense.
And the knee pads and all that stuff are part of the con, the unassumingness, I'm a geek. I'm just like,
exactly.
You know, regular guy.
Yeah. Keith used to say, I'm not a guru. I'm just a guy, you know, happen to have a very high IQ, but I'm just a guy.
Right. The part where he talks about sociopathy so openly was chilling because I had examples of that too, where it's like they almost tell you what they're doing.
Oh, they love to do that.
In a weird way that like nullifies you thinking that they're actually doing that because they just talked about it.
Got the lessons.
You've been obviously in therapy and talking to these experts and reading these books.
I haven't been in therapy.
Oh, but I thought you were with Stephen Hassan. No? Did I make that up? Or you just, he was just helping you.
No, no, we've been in touch and we've talked a bit, but this is something people kind of assume that I've gone through all kinds of specialized therapy and I haven't at all, not at all. That's why to me, it's so meaningful to have resources like listening to you guys. Mm-hmm. And that's why I've kind of devoured so many different books and done research and I get intrigued with all kinds of understanding like what is dissociation and cognitive dissonance and how that happens and listening to other people's stories and trying to kind of put it all together myself. That's been really helpful.
Is it a financial limitation getting therapy? I know it's not cheap.
Oh yeah. The people who understand specifically this type of thing, I would love to sit through therapy and I would have in the past, but obviously that stuff is very expensive and I'm sitting in a place of owing a lot of stuff all over the place.
Yes.
So I don't really feel free to do that, but I feel like I've been lucky that there's other resources out there to kind of help me figuring this stuff out for myself.
Well, certainly podcasts and books and movies, and I mean, it's helped Nebby and I tremendously.
For sure.
And so I feel like there's like this critical period of time right when people get out. That's when it's like critical to kind of have that
support system. Mm-hmm.
Support, because if you don't have the support and the awareness, it's very easy, because mine was so public too, it was very easy for somebody to come along and DM me and say the right things and get into my life and then create havoc. It's sort of really critical, right, when people get out to kind of, when you're in that weird, shocked, like still really confused, what happened to me state,
mm-hmm.
it's like you're still really vulnerable.
Right. We talk about it in the pod as a lot as cult hopping. And, you know, you're just going, you know, abusive relationship hopping. Right. Like it's
right. Yeah. And I think that the people who the sort of would be predators know, like if it's a public thing and they see what you've been through, they know you're vulnerable.
Yeah.
You know, having just kind of been through the shitstorm whirlwind and still reeling from it, it's like, ooh, that's a good, I can pounce there right now mm-hmm. because I know that person's still vulnerable.
Well, I hope that the Netflix series is healing for you in the same way that The Vow was for us in terms of reaching people, helping people, educating people. And, you know, you're going to get messages, I'm sure, of all kinds.
Yeah, I hope so. I have gotten a lot of really kind DMs from usually women who say something royally fucked up happened to me too. And, you know, I think people are very often don't talk about it because they're embarrassed.
Mm-hmm.
People very often don't talk about their own situations and being conned or manipulated or whatever's happened because they're embarrassed. So I hope that, you know, whoever's out there kind of like feeling some shame over falling for somebody, or, you know, maybe it'll help people feel a little less stupid. And one other thing I want to say is, like, I'm not intentionally giving a shout out to Netflix, but there's The Puppet Master.
Yes.
It was a 3-part documentary that came out a while ago. And I watched it sort of thinking like, oh yeah, I probably should watch this. And I was sort of half watching it and then got really was like, oh my God. And it sort of hit me like a truck. It's just a similar story. And so I haven't seen my own documentary, so I don't know. But to the extent that mine might be distractingly focused on, like, you know, oh, celebrities at the restaurant or this, I don't know. But one way or another, I just feel like that The Puppet Master is it's an important documentary.
It's on our list.
That tells a really important story as well.
That and Tinder Swindler have been the thing that people keep messaging us about right now.
I know. I haven't seen Tinder Swindler yet, but, you know, at some point I'm going to have to watch it, but I'm a little scared because I watched Puppet Master sort of alone unexpectedly and was kind of reeling from it for like a day and a half.
My last piece of unsolicited advice is,
I mean, yeah, keep them coming. I'll take them.
If you could choose to do more interviews and people ask you stuff that you don't want to talk about, refer them to the documentary, refer them to the book, because mm-hmm. once it's out there, like, you don't have to put yourself through that trauma again. It's enough that you did it, you know?
I mean, as you know from writing a book, it's like, it's hard to keep trying to explain something that's hard to explain.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can kind of do it in long form, you know, write it, edit it, say it as clearly as you possibly can, and then be done with it. Like, once it's done, be able to refer people to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And at least, like, you have it there on the record. Here's my answer. I've already addressed that. Here's my answer.
Mm-hmm.
By definition, all of this stuff is difficult to explain.
Yeah, the steps are difficult.
Once your punch is thrown, you don't have to keep throwing the same punch. It's kind of mm-hmm. what I've been telling Sarah. It's like, you already won that fight. It's already been told.
Yeah.
Amen. Well, Sarma, this is such a full circle interview.
Listening to your podcast has been like super healing, not only for the insights, but because you guys are funny. And it's like the exact right balance of being able to use humor as therapy. And
right.
Okay, here's what I think. Once you guys see the documentary, we could have a conversation and there's probably going to be a lot of things that we could riff on and make fun of, because there are so many, tragedy aside, there is a lot of comical ridiculousness.
Well, in the interim, Nippy will think of a nickname for him. And
yeah. I'm going to get on that.
And then, we'll circle back to that follow-up after the fox. The fox and the box.
The fox.
Thank you, Sarma, for trusting us again and for also creating a magical experience in your restaurant, which I don't know why I'm crying. Well, I'm crying because it's gone. It's gone. And it was wonderful. And it's a tragedy what he did. And I hope you remember that you created a truly a beautiful sanctuary, and you were ahead of your time, and you were, you know, you did something really remarkable and helped a lot of people and did change people's lifestyles.
Thank you, Sarma.
Imagine yourself walking into a forest. You can see the path and the trees, high above you. The air is crisp. You are walking towards your happy place. Allegedly, allegedly. Say it with me. Anything said here on this podcast about alleged cults, alleged MLM schemes, alleged douchebaggery, mindfuckery, criminality, spiritual fraud, or the like, is offered purely as commentary. Because the views and opinions expressed on A Little Bit Culty do not necessarily reflect on official policy or position of the podcast. And any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business individual, anyone, or anything. So just let these words drift into your mind without needing to focus on any of them. You are great. You are capable. You deserve to be happy. Nobody's mad at you, unless you're actually a narcissistic, culty criminal. If that's you, cut that shit out. Don't be a fuckwad. But if that's not you, again, you are great. You are capable. You deserve to be happy. A Little Bit Culty loves you. Wow, was that intense.
I'm proud of her. I think what she's doing takes guts. And that's all you can do in the situation when someone is going through that is just support them and hold that space. And she's doing it pretty admirably, if you ask me.
And I appreciate that she's not, you know, doesn't want to do a lot of media, but she chose us because we know that we're not going to sensationalize it and that ultimately this is now material for other people to learn from. And I think there are a lot of people who, in the right moment, especially with like loneliness and the time of right now, COVID, and somebody reaching out and giving you what you think you want can be very dangerous.
Absolutely. I have a little bit of a jangle for this one.
I'm sure this guy, Mr. Fox, had a lot of word salad. Speaking of salad.
One might say the essence of food, while I'm not an expert per se, is indeed raw, if you will. That is to say, if we are truly connected to our own rawness, we can then be aligned with our food. However, that comes with a caveat. If we connect deeply and holistically, we see raw backwards is indeed war. And at times, for human minds on lower frequency, raw is synonymous with war. And there is no place for war as it pertains to food. Yet, isn't that what war is all about?
That's really...
Thank you.
That's really deep, babe.
Or is it? You know what I mean?
Oh, and hey, breaking news. Since recording this episode, we have still not watched That Vegan because we're recording before the 16th. But we did speak to Sarma and she has. And we have discussed with her the possibility of potentially doing a follow-up with her to hear her take on the documentary in a separate episode, depending on how she's doing. We're not going to commit to that because we are all about supporting our guests and whatever is right for them. And that might not be right for her, but if it is, we're going to talk to her soon about what she thought about Bad Vegan. Although she did give us permission to say, generally, she was happy with it. There are a couple of things to clear up, as there always is. But we can't wait to watch it. Hope you do too. Please let us know what you think about it in the comments on our Instagram. And until next week.
Until next week. Wave us from Charos.
Don't join a cult. Be careful out there. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks, guys. Sinking down to the depths of the ocean.
Let's keep the conversation going. We'll be back soon with more episodes of A Little Bit Culty with more experts and survivors. And sometimes experts who are survivors, as well as some familiar faces from The Vow from HBO. If you've got suggestions or questions on upcoming topics, find us on Instagram at A Little Bit Culty.
And for more background on what brought me here, my memoir, Scarred, The True Story of How I Escaped Nexium, the Cult That Bound My Life, is available on Amazon, Audible, and where most books are sold.
If you'd like to help us spread the word about A Little Bit Culty podcast, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe.
Seriously, like, take out their phone and tell them to press subscribe. It takes a second. We're also available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every major listening app. And if you're listening on a smartphone, tap or swipe over the cover art of this podcast to find show notes and helpful resources.
You might also find some offers from our sponsors there. And when you support our sponsors, you help us keep this podcast going. Just don't be a little bit culty about it.
A Little Bit Culty is executive produced by me, your co-host, Sarah Edmondson, and Anthony Nippy Ames.
That's me.
Associate producer is Jess Tardy. Produced, edited, mixed, and mastered by Citizens of Sound. Our amazing theme song, Cultivated, is by John Bryant and co-written by Nigel Asselin. I'm Sarah Edmondson, and thanks for listening to A Little Bit Culty.